So what we wanted to do this morning was Charles would love to talk about some topics that are near and dear to his heart in the realm of dressage and classical horsemanship. And first of all, I'd love to get started by, I'm going to ask Charles to talk about a subject that he expresses so well, and that is how horses have changed over the decades that you've been involved in the sport. I'll use an expression that he said to me a number of years ago that's always resonated with me, which is that the sport horse decades ago was kind of, if you think of the keys on a piano, was kind of like one octave, and that the breeding has produced horses that now are capable of multiple octaves in terms of, if you think of the octaves or a singer's range of collection to extension, the range, the octaves have gotten so much broader. And I love the way you talk about that. And can you just talk?
All right, so it is a very important topic that I always feel that now we live in the age of the superior horse and the minimal rider. So the minimal rider is not too derogatory in a physical way. Somewhat the excellent breeding of the horses is bringing them with so much correct motion, balance, rhythmic movement, and elastic movements that there's really nothing to develop. So the little foal drops on the ground when he's born and has the flying changes all tapped down and has basically the vocabulary of the great gates without needing the rider to enhance or improve those gates. Not too long ago, the rider's knowledge, particularly his mental, the academic knowledge and the emotional understanding of the horse, was very necessary to build something completely new. Riders had to actually create. One can use the bad phrase manufacture the trot or the canter, because the horses came to riders so meager that anything you wanted to get out of them athletically, it was a magician's work of starting from meager resources and make it into an edifice of strength and skill and a piece of art in motion. Now this is given to you when you buy the horse somewhere in an auction or wherever, because you are getting a superior unit. And sometimes when the match is not quite correct or adequate, the rider actually proceeds to break it down. The motion is too big, too bold, too energetic, too out of control to the level of the rider who bought it. And it's almost has to be put into reverse and say, well, you are too good for me at the moment. Let me see if I can get you small, mincing, shuffling, uneven, and rotten. And then when I succeeded making you miserable, you will be a perfect match for me. So the point is then what Jennifer was saying, that you always have to think of the horse's skills and strength on a continuum, and see, and your goal is of course to increase the variables. So a good rider, I always kid my riders during a lesson that you have two kind of trots, fast bad trot and a slow bad trot, and we would need to have 249 different trots and 107 canters and 11 walks. And when you are in front of a judge, you turn your dial and say, this diagonal will be trot number 172. And you put your dial there and go, and then it's medium trot gets a 9 because you selected on your dial this wonderful thing that's available to you. But a rider's goal is always to increase the rider's facility to perform each gait in more precise control of the rider and in a far greater variety. So have we got the two ideas? You know, more precise and greater variety. And this is very much easier to get from our superb horses today than it was 50 years ago on a miserable backyard creature from a peasant yard in Bulgaria. So this is a very fortunate world that I don't think the sport has ever seen, because prior to this age, horses were still utilitarian, so they were bred for carriage and for hunting and for agricultural use, pulling a plow or something, and there was no breeding goal saying Olympic gold medal. You know, this is a new breeding goal in the post-equestrian age, when the horse is not utilitarian in work and industry. So this is completely different. My problem with this is dual, or my recommendation is to pay attention to two things. Because the horse comes to you as a youngster, and on the first day of your riding is already performing many things that would be fourth level or St. George. I mean, you let him take flight in a nice medium trot. Well, you got your basically your St. George medium trot, because the horse you bought doesn't have a shabby one. So the obvious invitation is, let's skip stages. The art of riding is very important to be knowledgeable and systematic and gradual. And these principles must stay with you, because you say, well, I don't have to be systematic because I have my medium trot and my extended trot. So I can omit certain developmental stages. But the horse, being a living thing and has to develop not just the body but the mind, the understanding that you just now dialed to trot number 172, he has a lot of knowledge to acquire in the year ahead of you. You can't skip these stages, because then there'll be a calamity down the road where he said, darn it, why didn't I teach him, you know, trot number 87, because now he omits it because I omitted it, and so on. So the gradual, systematic, appropriate development is now being confused, ignored, avoided, and played with more or less on emotional basis and not scientific or academic basis. The other concern of mine with the superior horse is that judges and teachers and riders, so the cognoscenti, the people who are supposed to know academic equitation and the science of riding and horse development, somehow forgot that it's all about, ultimately, it's all about collection. That is the ability of the rider and the horse to shift the combined center of gravity towards the haunches and liberate the forehand, the weaker part of the horse. So the horse will travel over the forehand, but do not dwell on it. So there'll be never an impaction, stress on the forehand. That would be the dwelling on the forehand. But that the horse will travel over it, but not stress or dwell on the forehead. So the shifting of the haunches toward the haunches is ignored because the splendid moving horse gives you the illusion that is always engaged. It is not true, because while riding is of course controlled transportation, it doesn't mean that you control where you go, but you have to also control how you get there. And the modern riders run like maniacs because they realize that the concept of energy is a very important part of the goals of what we develop from horse. But they forget that we are supposed to create a horse that works with maximum energy but minimum effort. So speed is the enemy of engagement. The racehorse has no engagement. And the horse that runs, and horses escape taking weight and correctly engaging on the hindquarters in three ways: inversion above the bit, or overflexed. Number two, run. Speed is an escape. If a horse reacts to leg aids only by speeding, you mistrained him. Leg aids is stimulus for increased engagement of the joints, not the travel speed. The odometer doesn't increase. And the third escape, of course, is crookedness. Four ways to be crooked, and the horse combines the four ways into a telephone book of crookedness. And he can vary it and vary it quickly. And to straighten the horse and ride it forward was an advice not for speed. It was the advice, forward had only one meaning: an imaginary connection of hocks to bridle, the termination point of the energy, viewed as a bowstring of a bow. And you can tighten and shorten the bowstring in collection, or lengthen and enlarge the bowstring when the horse's posture is allowed to be longer or shorter. But all the time, you determine the variable scale of the posture, and the goal of forward is not run like hell. No, no, no. It's slow down and increase the scope of the articulation of the horse's joints. It's a completely different concept. And this business of competitors running on an out-of-balance horse with irregular, uneven, unsuspended, shuffling, miserable, stiff strides is the opposite of what we recommend.
Now, Charles, you've talked about the great talents of these sport horses today.
Yes.
But of course, as you know, if you stayed for any of the awards last night after the Hall of Fame induction, there's a whole complement of all breeds awards. So there,
yes,
are many, many people, particularly in this country, who are riding dressage on horses other than these supercalifragilistic warm bloods. Are they just, what are they to do? Are they out of luck?
No. When you do systematic schooling of a horse, you can really allow, the whole goal is to bring the latent talent of the horse and make it an educated, developed display of the latent talent. So all riding aims to improve the basic gaits, both in balance and in articulation of the limbs, in other words, the transportation. And of course, when it succeeds, you see actually greater performance with less effort, but also a slower horse. Hence, the inclusion of the majestic school canter to pirouette and the majestic passage. Those are demonstrations that look how much energy I can put in front of you without running. So if you have different horses, the goal remains the same. Horse is a random, unique, interesting, and noble creature of nature. The rider has to be familiar with the Baroque idea that with the intelligence and emotional content, humans can alter, groom, adjust, and tame nature and make it into a piece of art by allowing this random piece of uneducated nature to perform in a way he would have never performed on his own on the pasture. This is the Baroque idea of human intelligence and will can ennoble random nature, which is unique, and it has to give it system and some uniformity. So this ideology is at the heart of horse training. So if you have little Brownie from Montana with very meager resources, and you develop his little food processing, shuffling trot into a rhythmically rising cadence, 1, 2, I suspend trot. In other words, you turn the shuffle into an international trot fit for Amsterdam competition. Then you basically won your own Olympics, because this is the goal. The difference between that in Montana and the Olympic gold winner is that she bought a better resource to develop to those grades and the Olympic gold medal. The Montana girl has a more meager resource, but because she developed it to its utmost, she deserves also her own gold medal. So I hope I explained that clearly, because the glory or the pride or the achievement should be known as identical. The Olympic winner is, of course, on a better resource, and maybe with better knowledge, because a better resource needs more finesse. It takes a better violinist to play a Stradivarius than a six-year-old boy. So we know that. So the mastery of this evolution of random nature to elegant art is in the hand of a great artist. It's one of the big problems of contemporary riding, that stages are omitted because the horse is talented, and the other one is that nobody understands that the ultimate goal is the seatedness. And that also brings me to the haunches have to amplify the use of the joints when the training is correct. And some riders succeed with almost all of the joints, but they omit the lumbosacral joint, in other words, the point of the croup. And the horses are, in this modern training method, the horses are not asked or encouraged or trained to tilt the pelvis forward, to supple the hips, and to lower the croup and actually flex the lumbosacral joint and be seated and tucked under. And riders pay no attention to the horse articulating with the joints on impaction. So all training with this haste and running is the kind of training carriage horses needed. They ran as fast as because you hurried to the dentist, and they have to run in front of the carriage, and the weight is behind them. They run like hell, and they bounce the croup as high as possible to be able to get with kinetic energy to the dentist office. The riding horse is the opposite. It is to rock back, and of course the ideal end result, the image you could have in mind, is the levade. The entire horse is on two tiny hoofs in the back. The hocks are this far from the ground. There's so much articulation that the hocks are, and the entire tonnage above the two little feet are this deep to the ground, and the horse is not falling over. So the horse, the entire structure is balanced up and forward, no more horizontality. And this miracle means that all joints have been strengthened and elasticized. And what in the energy level is so important to also understand, that we always value, you know, the articulation of the joints that are airborne, because that, of course, a rider should be aware of it, because that's the side on which you can aid and stimulate energy. So, but when that same limb is impacting on the ground, it should sink. A well-trained horse sinks to the ground. You see a lot of high-level competition horses with open joints, and they beat the ground, and they drive nails into the boards, so to speak, instead of treading like a cat on stalking a prey. They should sink to the ground and softly rock downward, approaching the floor when they are impacting, to save their joints. If they are still open, training level test one, and hammer the joints on a St. George test, it's not really correct. Can you follow that logic? Mm-hmm. So what we are losing because of the superior breeding of the horse is that you can do this spectacular tilling of the air in the front and say, look how light he is. The devil he is not, because he's walking behind. You know, the front is flipping, but the guy is not supporting his weight from behind. Then, of course, we lose sight that the whole thing should be much slower and much more bowed over the bowstring, which is hock to bridle line. And it's very important, because it's not just the hock is the joint that moves the horse from here to there, but the bridle is the termination point of the horse's energy. So the horse's throughness, or being correctly in a correct posture, using his muscles correctly to put the action into the bridle, is a very important concept, and the horse has to do it. So,
I have to ask you though, yes? Just because I just thought of this while you were talking. You're talking about terminating at the bridle.
Yes.
There are some people today who feel that you can do correct dressage equally well with, yes, a bitless bridle.
Absolutely.
Who
contacts? The horse, not the rider. What does the horse contact? A piece of metal hanging, keyword, hanging in his mouth. It's not, it's hanging. With what does he contact the bridle? With his hocks, with the joints of energy, not with his mouth. The mouth is for eating and drinking. He connects his energy to a hanging termination point, which is, of course, controlled by the rider's seat, because if he puts too much contact or energy into it, he should not dislodge the rider. He should draw the rider down into himself. Thereby, the rider redefines the center of gravity, and he can strike into it with his haunches and reshape his bow to lightness. Yeah, it's a process. And the focus of it is the rider's seat. So anyway, so the horse, so then we can have no beat but terminate maybe a hackamore or a noseband or something. Then why do we have this beat and all that thing? We found it more efficient in emergencies, which should maybe never come in a horse's life, but if it does come, the beat is a more powerful unit with you can use to strengthen your seat, because when you stress the bit or the horse stresses it, it should wedge you into his back stronger. So it's a seat authority through the extension of the rein, but it's a seat authority. So this is one reason, but the most important reason is that the reins, with the help of the bridle, are the paramount instrument in the alignment of the horse. So straighten your horse to ride it forward. The straightening part of that sentence is all about the reins. Because I feel... So the alignment of the horse is not simple, because it's three things. You have to align the horse's spinal position over the pattern on which he moves, evenly bent. So a functionally straight horse on a 20-meter circle is, of course, bent. That's why we call him straight, because the alignment is on the curvature of his traction. Number two, the hind legs have to support the center of gravity evenly. On most horses, right hind leg crosses like a leg yield, long, towards the left front, huge mistake. Left hind leg is short and stressed. You have to ride until he's ambidextrous and totally even. Number three, the hind leg has to strike in the direction of corresponding front, not to the center, or not sideways. And this directional alignment, the spinal alignment, and the evenness of the hind legs are all dependent on your rein and your rein contact and what you do with it to encourage the horse's even bending from pole to tail. So that's why we want the bridle, because on a hackamore or any other apparatus, you could not align the hind legs that correctly. Mm. So that's the instrument. Okay. But it should not be a pull.
I know you wanted to talk a little bit about how dressage training has changed.
Yes, this is
over the years.
Yes, we are already talking about it. Dressage training changed a lot. And actually, of course, everything is improving. So we already said the horses are unbelievably improved. I mean, this could not be even imagined in decades earlier, what we have now as available horses. And with it, in a way, everything, judging and teaching also, I think, is much better. And the challenges are different and much more sophisticated, because in the good old days, no horses went even in longitudinal flexion, in other words, on the beat and trueness, so riders really didn't have access to the haunches in those years when the struggle was just to have a horse in the correct position or the correct posture to ride. And now, of course, that's a done deal. There's nothing to worry about. But now we have the luxury to only bother with the sophistication of how much we get in collection, in the ability to shift the weight towards the haunches. Because ultimately, the goal of all riding is to get the maximum performance from any horse, again, random nature to art. Whatever your horse genetically is offering, you should be able to develop it into full bloom. This is the overall goal. But on the way to achieve this goal, the sub-goals are collection, as much weight to the haunches as possible. Is it also in the extended trot? Yes, the extended trot should be collected. This sounds like an idiot, a game on words. If the extended trot falls to the forehand and the haunches cannot overstrike the footprint of the forehand, you are not in an extended trot. You are in a run. So is the extended trot collected? Yes. Everything in correct riding, everything is collected. The horse is always on his haunches. The word for this is engaged. Engagement, of course, has five meanings, but one of which is that he remains consistently in self-carriage with the majority of the weight in the haunches and no longer on the forehand. So that's one definition of engagement. So we train for engagement, and from it, one of the spectacular results is increased suspension. So the horse travels over space through the air, not by pulling himself on the floor. Yeah? So he's not crawling forward or out of balance. He makes a touchdown, an impaction on the ground, so precise and so schooled that from that small bounce against the ground, he can float in elegant suspension a longer distance. So minimum effort to maximum performance comes from skills and strength. That's another purpose of training. If you don't, and all of this has to go through a liquid structure of the horse, so when the horse trots or canters or does anything, he has to do it in his entirety and not with his legs only, and the body left out of it. So when a horse in his entirety is engaged in minimum effort to maximum performance, which is visible as collection and suspension, you got your Grand Prix horse. These are the goals. Where did you hear as one of the goals to run like hell? I haven't heard that. I went to riding school 4 years. They never said, yeah, when the horse has 209 different trots, there are two trots out of that are fast. So your coach might say, push the fast button on this slug today, yeah? Yeah, that could be, but then it's a choice. It's not chasing the horse from morning till night.
So the speed, the confusion, yes, between speed and engagement, it sounds as if the biggest training...
Exactly. And what happens is the more they hold the front and the more they agitate the haunches, the higher the butt bounces. So they all become butt bouncers. Instead of the horse crouching. So the horse is supposed to, you know, tilt pelvis forward and sink, and the tail lower and the whole structure to, you know, raise the front. Instead of that, the horse is agitated as if against a wall, I mean the strong hands. So he's kicked, so he dances higher in the buttocks. So you see the silhouette of the horse coming on whatever, 20-meter circle or something, Grand Prix horse, and the back is hollowed, a hammock, the buttocks is up, the pole is up, huge front, and the hind end, short-stepping. How many times did you observe the footprints of the hind legs relative to the front legs? Medium trot, understriding. Is this a medium trot? Of course not. But you look at the scoreboard, 7 and 8. Yeah, this is a butt-bouncing horse. This delivered the big trot with the hind end back in the box stall. It didn't support anything. And so many times it's
So is this the rider's fault, or the trainer's fault, or
both.
Is this the judge's fault?
They don't address
it. Is this the judge's fault
the
for
judge
rewarding
should,
it?
No, the judge should give it a much lower score. There was, I always agonized about this when I was judging, because we had judges' forums, and then, of course, there was a majority of scores, and then if you had something very deviant from it, very away from it, you were asked why, and that's how it should be. So I like that very much. But I remember one thing, extend a walk on the diagonal, and this horse had by then not a correct walk. He never overstrode, but he never even stepped into the footprint of the forehand with his hind legs. He was understriding, so false collection. He wasn't collected. In fact, the frame was lengthened, in this case almost too much. It more looked like a free walk than an extended walk, a horse completely allowed to stretch. And that's not a bad idea, but anyway, that's all there was. And understriding, absolutely short behind, very stiff. So everybody, you know, beautiful length. You have to lengthen the frame. Oh, 6 and 7, I don't remember. So I was 4. And 4 is becoming a big no-no. You give a 4, you get grilled, you have the medieval torture set on you. So why 4? And then, actually, the argument was, well, but didn't you see the longer frame? I said, extended walk is not defined by a longer frame. It's a reference to how much territory he passes per stride. He understrode. Oh, but it was so nice. At least you should have been a 5, if not a 6. So regular. Yes, regularly understriding. So there was this big argument, and my fear is that if we redefine every movement, if in the extended walk you don't really have to extend anymore, then everything is 9 or whatever. I always say sarcastically that those of us who don't know where we are going, we always arrive. Because you just do it wrong and I am great, you know? No. Extended walk, overstride, yeah, but hopefully a foot. I mean, not overstride one hoof print, but the whole foot. Why not? So no, now we redefine it. Oh, he had such a nice top line and a good stride. No, that's not extended walk. So anyway, these arguments in judges' forums are very useful, because some people, you know, actually want to hear that or want to have an opinion and say, how should I judge next time I see this? And I think today so much is ignored about the high croup, the shortening and choppiness of stride. And what we forget too is, you know, oh, I watched the impulsion and the articulation of the joints in the hindquarters, which is correct. That's where you are supposed to watch it and notice it. But we forget that the horse's hind legs are also his brakes. So if a horse trots and you want from on the forehand to horizontal trot to raise the forehand up to this free, you know, the withers up and the hind leg fully supporting and overstriding to make this transfusion, this transmission of from the forehand to the haunches, the horse has to use a hind leg a lot as brakes. He slows the forehand. If the forehand is the same speed as the hind end, it never rises. Do you understand that somehow? Because with aeroplanes taking off, we don't see that. We don't think that the wheels of the aeroplane is slowing the plane to take off. But in riding, when you lighten a horse's forehand half halt, in other words, use his legs to slow him, to slow the kinetic bulk of his heavy chest and shoulders, not to pull him forward. You slow the front and raise it, and then put the hind leg under it. I hope you understand that, because the horse is a horizontal pipe, and it's very hard to raise a long, heavy lead pipe with holding just the end of it, and you try to raise it up like a fishing pole, and it's very hard. It breaks your wrist because you are in a long pole, is a heavy item. And the horse is that long pole that you have to raise like a fishing pole in front of you by the hind leg of the horse breaking on the forehand. So if you chase a horse into full speed, it's a nightmare. It's the opposite. You never break the front. He's rolling with kinetic energy, unexercised.
Well, you've talked a lot about these pervasive misconceptions.
Yes.
And that kind of segues into something else that I know you wanted to talk about, which is, you know, how do we fix this? How do we get this knowledge across? And I know something that is near and dear to your heart is you'd love to see something along the lines of an academy,
yes,
like the one in which you were trained in Hungary.
Yes.
People have talked over the years about the idea of having a national riding academy in the United States. Obviously, it has, with the exception perhaps of the effort of the American Dressage Institute, which never really went nationwide, we've never really had one. And yet you still think that we need,
yes,
to have one. What is it that you would like to see, and how would you create it?
Well, what I would like to see is an expert authority put in place that defines these things and talks about them and holds the forums and the meetings. There are many substitute actions in that, like in Florida, the dressage meeting coming up in February and so on. These are like experiencing 2 days at the National Academy, but where are the other 350 days? So for 2 days you wet your feet and then you are sent home and say, oh, you know, but this, to have a body of experts who guide the understanding of the science of riding. A national academy also, so it's a quality check. Today we have quality inspectors at Clorox or someplace. Well, this would be quality inspectors, but also teaching academy on a university level. Also important would be from an academy that people could go and consult. And the most important is that riding must or should address the entire human being, which is really mind, spirit, and body. The body is the one, the pleasure of riding, the sport of riding, and we address the body, unfortunately, quite wrongly, because we don't teach riders always how to do it. But the body of the three elements is the least important, and an academy has a chance to address the science of riding, the academic, intellectual aspect of riding, to know the subject, like extended walk has to overstride the footprint of the forehand. So there are academic things and health things and so on. Only an academy. How do you teach that in a two-day clinic in Montana? And then riders take two-day clinics for 28 years, and they don't have a clue how to adjust the nose bend. In an academy, this is swept out of the way in the first 2 weeks of instruction. In other words, that there is no systematic, standardized instruction where people understand right from wrong, wrong from right, the science of riding, and so on.
How would you enact an academy in the in a country the size of ours? That's always
this
been
is,
the problem.
Yeah, this was the second half of your question, and you can't. I couldn't. In the 70s, I quested. I had many written proposals. I submitted it to colleges, universities who had equestrian programs, and they all nixed it. And then I proposed it to private friends who were wealthy people, and they all said it's impossible because financially it's a total loser. It's like, you know, lighting $100 bills with matches. You can't finance it. This is terrible. And my last proposal was, I thought was very good, but all businessmen rejected. I have no business mind at all. But the one finally I said, why don't we do a unique thing like the best climate in the world, Big Sur, California, up in the mountains, no motors, engines, and gasoline. You park your car at the bottom on Highway 1. You are met by a carriage and horses, and you are trotted up to the riding academy where you live in silence and concentration, and you have tennis court, swimming pool, and it's a resort. And you offer it for summer camp for rotten teenagers that parents cannot handle, and they need to be, and they would be parked in your riding academy.
The parents might pay for that.
No, they would. The parents would pay, and we would teach these monsters horseback riding because the teachers, this would, an academy is a place to teach, to train teachers and judges. So these teachers would have guinea pigs, paying guinea pigs. These teenagers would pay to stay in the resort, and these would be the ones we teach, and I could supervise, well, I or another teacher, the young teachers as to their skills, teach them methodology, which I do in England and in Sweden. I teach this kind of thing, and it works wonderfully. So anyway, it was always rejected on financial basis. Nobody said it's a stupid idea. Nobody said the country is too big for it. They all said it is a recipe for bankruptcy. And I, as I said, the resort idea I thought should have made money or possible. And they said, no, it's wrong.
All right, well, there's the challenge to everybody.
There's the challenge.
Well, what I would like to do is, we have only about 5 or so minutes left.
Yes.
I would love to open it up to anybody who has a question for Charles. Yes, ma'am. And I'll repeat the question.
Yes.
So that we can get it on the
Tara.
Audio. So the question is from somebody who's recently become a member of the USDF instructor certification faculty, and she would like Charles to speak to how to inspire the mind and spirit of the rider as well as the body.
It is a process that never ends. It's very similar to life itself, how to live life well. But it does start with discussions about what is the meaning of the horse and nobles, the man's character. And there are some very serious thoughts in that direction, and that should be known to all participants. And the only way, because books have not been written about this, here and there in a chapter I mention it sometimes, but riders should become aware that this is very much an art for the spirit or for the character, and it is to develop riding when correctly practiced, is to develop the virtues that make adult responsible humans out of egocentric, narcissistic children. And this was always, you know, that in each language in Europe, a nobleman, an aristocrat, is the same word as a rider. Chevalier, cavaliere, Ritter in German, etc. It means you are an aristocrat, yeah, but incidentally, it's the term for a rider. So once you are a rider, you are elevated to the aristocracy of humanity, because it develops the emotional integrity and the virtues of the rider. And this should be explained, and there is no shortcut about that. And it was fostered in us by example and lecturing and scolding for 4 years. Hence, I never punished or beat a horse. It didn't exist. You punished a horse, that's a character problem, you know. Punishing horses is dirty. And we had zero tolerance. You were noticed once to do that. You stood up your whip and did whoosh, whoosh. You were forever out, but you really literally could not enter through the gate of the school, the academy. You were literally a pariah. You were forever banished. Ethics. Ethics only. If you don't have the character to deal with it without this, you don't belong here. Get out. So yes, it is the hardest. Character development is what used to be called upbringing, and now parents abdicated. They don't do upbringing, they pasture the children, so they grow up like pasture. And academies, riding academies, must address the inner life of the rider.
The question was, could Charles speak to the relationship between tempo and running and collection?
Every horse is, because of his conformation and structure and mental state, nature, every horse has a signature rhythm in motion. It's very much like our fingerprints. No one else has it. So when you take a young horse or any horse, a third level horse, and you ride it, you discover, if you have feeling, you understand his signature rhythm. And you have to aid him in that rhythm, in the regularity of his footfall, to successfully engage him. Otherwise, you produce speed and not engagement. So the tempo of the horse is how much distance he covers within a set period of time. And you can, the better trained your horse is, the more choice you have to adjust your tempo. A very green horse has one tempo, fast. And so, fast and stiff. But, so the tempo is already one adjustable part of your wisdom made manifest. But it is always based on the signature natural rhythm the horse brings to you, and that you have to understand before you can adjust the tempo.
Okay, yeah. So the question is, Charles wrote in a recent book about taking horses out and galloping them in the fields and the woods, and noting that people today don't seem to do that very much or don't have the space to do it. And also that horses today often live a pretty confined lifestyle, maybe aren't ridden out, maybe aren't turned out. And what are his thoughts about how that affects the horses?
So in correct training that we pursued in academies, the heart of it was diversification. We were to ride hundreds of different horses and in hundreds of different ways, and be outside and ride cross-country in groups or in pairs or in many different ways with different assignments was essential to the horse's clarity of mind and training, and for us even to discover that signature rhythm of a horse when he trots. How if you have a 4 mile road through a forest and the horse begins to make his trot, how you start to sense where he is in his rhythmic integrity. Yes, this diversification would be at the heart of any reputable national riding academy, because dressage is not, it's a specialized way of showing for evaluation, but it's not the total athletic horse. And the basic training of the horse, the first 2 years were always dedicated to basic from age three to five, made the athletic horse, and then you separated by talent into dressage, jumping, or cross-country work. By age five, the horse makes it clear where his talents lie. And there are fabulous archival things on the internet. I kind of lost mine. I don't know how, maybe I eliminated it, but there was the Hungarian Riding Academy that was before me, when the officers who taught me were training. In fact, those people who taught me are on that film doing the riding, and they do what was absolutely part of, they do cross-country riding through forest, rivers, ponds, and they jump, climb, spring, sprint, swim, and everything for, it's a, like a 20-minute film, it's breathtaking. You said, I never knew horses. I had no idea this can be even done. And no horse broke a leg, no horse drowned, no rider fell off. Nothing was happening except a gorgeous ride from hither to yonder with something like 40 horses. It's a huge, and this was the heart of all academies. You ride a horse, not a porcelain toy from a vitrine. And no bandages either. The horses had no bandages, nothing. Well, you are still not allowed in competition to bandage, but we were not allowed to bandage full period, unless the vet said, this needs 4 days of whatever wrap. But no, you made the sinews like steel, like nature meant it.
Well, I think we're out of time. Please join me in thanking Charles DeCunfey for all your time and expertise. Thank you so much.
Thank you.